The garbage bag, caught on a thermal hook and spun in the air, teased and tugged by unseen hands. Luther lowered the volume on the N-8 track. City silence, the sigh of a distant bus, the tide of the interstate. Grover Washington Jr., setting faint, intricate fires up and down the length of Trouble Man. Beyond that, nothing. Luther felt his attention beginning not so much to wander as to migrate, seeking opportunity elsewhere, far down the coast highway, at the wheel of his beautiful green muscle car. He made his way to Los Angeles, capital of the rest of his life. In a helicopter shot, he watched himself rolling across an arcaded bridge with the ocean and the dawn and the last of the night spread out all around him. He heard the stuttering crack of a number of firearms discharging at once. The door of the Bit of Honey banged open again, spraying horns and shouts. Chan came out at a running walk. He got into the car and slammed the door. Blood streaked his left shoe like a bright feather. The shotgun gave off its sweet, hellish smell, electricity, and sizzling fatback. Luther shifted into first gear, standing on the gas pedal, balanced on it and on the moment like the trumpeter angel you saw from the Warren Freeway, perched at the tip of the Mormon Temple, riding the wild spin of the world itself. Everything Detroit could muster in the way of snarling poured from the 450 engine. They parlayed a dizzying string of green lights all the way to Claremont Avenue. It had been a case of love at first sight for Luther and the Toronado 2 days before, at a used car lot down on Broadway. Now, as they tore up Telegraph, something slid coiling through his belly, more like a qualm of lust. Chan tossed his brother's Halloween mask out of the open window, slid the gun under the seat. He peeled away the gloves and started to throw them out too, but in the end seemed to want to hold on to them, the right one bloody and powder-burned, a while longer. He sat there clutching them in one fist like a duelist looking for someone to slap. At the Claremont intersection, with no one after them and no sign of the law, Luther eased the car into a red light. Just an ordinary motorist, window down, elbow hooked over the door, grooving on the passage of another summer evening. Somewhere in the vicinity, he had once been told, covered over by time and concrete, lay the founding patch of human business in this corner of the world. Miwok Indians dreaming the dream, living fat as bears, piling up their oyster shells, oblivious to history with its oncoming parade of motherfuckers. "What happened?" Luther said to Chan, affecting lightness. Only then, in the wake of posing this awful question, did he begin to feel something like dread. Chan just turned up the volume on the music. "Chan, you did it?" Luther could see Chan struggling to frame the story of what had transpired inside the Bit of Honey lounge in some way that did not infuriate him. One thing Chandler Flowers hated more than being underestimated for his intelligence was giving evidence of any lack thereof. The light turned green. Luther stared for mysterious reasons, and in the absence of counter-instruction from his companion, toward the image in his mind of that westernmost angel blowing that apocalyptic horn. A minute went by which Joe Beck and his guitar organized according to their own notions of time and its fuzz-tone passage. At last, Flowers emitted, as through a tight aperture, four words. "Shot off his hand. Left or right?" "The right hand." "He a righty or lefty?" "Why? Is Popcorn a righty or a lefty?" "You are suggesting if Popcorn Hughes turns out to be right-handed, maybe I mess this job up a little less. Because at least now Popcorn only has the hand he doesn't use." Luther reflected as they rumbled up Tunnel Road toward the spot where, invisibly, as a decision turning bad, it became the Warren Freeway. "No," he conceded at last. After this, they did not speak at all. Luther went on reflecting. At 7 in the morning, Monday, he was expected to report to a rented soundstage down in Studio City to film his first scenes for Strutter, a low-budget action movie in whose lead he had recently been cast. He was driving around tonight in the upfront money from that job. There was 10 grand yet to come, and after that, anything. Sequels, endorsements, television work, the parts that Jim Brown was too busy to take, a co-starring role with Burt Reynolds. Now, through some damned interlocking of bravado, loyalty, and the existential heedlessness that had helped him to become the 1972 middleweight karate champion of the world, Luther had nodded his pleasantly indistinct future like a sack full of kittens to the plunging stone of Chan Flowers. Tonight had gone wrong, but even if Popcorn, as planned, had caught a fatal chest full of lead shot and pumped out his life in a puddle under a table by the stage, the situation would have been no better. True, the seed of Panther legend that Chan Flowers hoped to cultivate as Chan the Undertaker Flowers, killer of men, a real one, not some make-believe hard-ass in a low-budget grindhouse feature, would have been planted. True, the ongoing mental distress caused to Huey Newton by the continued existence of Popcorn Hughes might have been assuaged. But there still would have been no benefit whatsoever to Luther Stallings. Success of the mission would have been another kind of failure, even deeper shit than Luther was in now. Luther had no politics, no particular feelings toward drug dealers like Popcorn or toward the Black Panthers who had targeted them. He did not care who controlled the city of Oakland or its ghetto streets. He had seen Huey Newton once in his life, black leather jacket, easy smile, talking some shit about disalienation at a house party in the Berkeley Flatlands, and had marked him right away as just another stylist of gangster self-love. Luther Stallings, future star of blaxploitation and beyond, had no call to be here, no interest in the outcome either way. Chan asked him to drive, so Luther drove. Now, instead of a murder in his rearview mirror, there was the bloody trail of a fuck-up. Meanwhile, the image of the golden angel of the Mormons soloing atop his spire worked its strange allure on Luther's imagination. "Take a left," Chan said as they rolled off the freeway at the Park Avenue exit. Luther was about to protest that a left turn would lead them away from the temple when he realized he had no real reason to want to go to that place. The vague longing to bear some kind of witness to the glory of the angel Moroni winked out inside him, crumbled like ash. Luther aimed the Toronado up Joaquin Miller Road. "Where are we going?" he said. "I need to think," said the smartest boy in the room. He stared out at the night that streamed like a downpour across the windshield. Then, "Shut up."
"I didn't say nothing," Luther said,
though he most definitely had been tossing around some combination of words along the lines of, "Ain't it a little late for that now?"
"Yeah, I was in that dog pile one time," Moby was saying.
"Down in L.A.?"
Moby was one of the noontime regulars. He was a lawyer, none too unusual a career path for a $300 a month abuser of polyvinyl chloride, except that Moby's clients were all cetaceans. His real name was Mike Oberstein. He was, notably, given the moniker, white and size 2XL. Wore his longish hair parted down the center and slicked back over his ears in twin flukes. Moby worked for a foundation out of an office in the same building as Archie's wife, bringing action against SeaWorld on behalf of Shamu's brother-in-law, suing the Navy for making humpbacks go deaf. He was a passionate and free-spending accruer of 50s and 60s jazz sides.
"It was pretty tight," Moby added.
"Was it?"
Nat said, giving a bottle to Rolando English, who sat fastened safely into an infant carrier, propped up on the counter by the cash register. Nat kept his gaze fixed on the baby so that, Archie understood, he would not have to kill Mike Oberstein with gamma rays shot out of his eyeballs.
"Was it banging?"
Archie knew, could not help knowing all the man's rants and treatises on the subject, how it bothered Nat that Moby tried so hard, to be honest, probably wasn't even trying anymore, to sound like he was from the hood, from round the way, as Moby would have put it, even though he was a sweet-natured white guy from Indiana someplace.
"It was straight up banging," Moby said,
so well armored in his sweetness and his imaginary superfly fur coat that he was impervious, if not oblivious, to the eyeball lightning that was always forking in his direction. No joke. Found me this crazy side called, Nat, get this, Jimmy Smith Live in Israel. Thought it was a myth. I've been looking for that for like years.
Nat nodded, watching the formula steadily disappear from the bottle, while in his imagination, as Archie could infer by the knot of Nat's shoulders, he took a pristine pressing of Jimmy Smith in Israel, Isradisc, 1973, out of its sleeve and snapped it over his knee. Twice, into quarters, then handed it back to Moby without a word, not even needing to say, man, fuck Dogpile, and the motherfucking Dogpile blimp.
Part I don't understand, all due respect, is why y'all act like some kind of invasion, said the King of Bling. Dogpile coming into this neighborhood.
Garnett Singletary, Baby Rolando's grandfather, was sitting beside Moby at the glass display counter that ran nearly half the length of the south wall of the store, at the end farthest from the window, in order to preserve a certain distance between himself and the parrot. 58, the African gray, sat perched on the shoulder of Cochise Jones, who occupied his usual stool tucked into the corner by the window. Mr. Jones, with that inveterate hunch to his spine from 50 years conducting experiments at the keyboard of a Hammond B3. Decades of avian companionship had raised a fuzz of claw marks at the shoulders of Mr. Jones's green leisure suit, tussocks on the padded polyester lawn. Restless as a radio telescope, the parrot's head with its staring eye plowed the universe for invisible signs and messages. Every so often, 58, whose public utterances tended to be musical, would counterfeit the steely vibrato of his owner's B3, break out into a riff, a stray middle eight, the bird programming its musical selections with an apparent randomness in which Singletary, who feared and admired the bird, claimed to find evidence of calculation and ironical intent.
Gibson Good was born here, Singletary continued when no explanation was forthcoming from either partner.
Singletary was in his mid-50s but looked 30. Hair sprang carefully from his head in micro-dreads no thicker than his grandson's fingers, his smile easy and warm, his eyes as cold as pennies at the bottom of a well. Like 58's, those eyes missed nothing, cloaking in a universal fog of conversation the ceaseless void of his surveillance. Archie wondered if the man's unease around the bird arose from recognition of a rival or a peer.
Singletary said, man grew up down in L.A., but his granny still living over in Rumford Plaza. Y'all was operating in Atlanta, New York, and this dude showed up in his great big black blimp. I might understand how you could feel some resentfulness. But Gibson Good is a semi-local product, like the eyes teaming up with the smile to give notice that he was about to mess with Nat. If you was to put you and Archie together, half local, half out of town. Half and half, Nat said, humming to himself, pouring the formula into Rolando English. The boy definitely had an appetite. They had run through the bottles of Good Start by 11 this morning and were working on a can of Enfamil powder mixed with water at Brooklyn's bathroom sink. The Enfamil provided by S.S. Merchandani from a deep, remote, and spidery shelf over at Temescal Liquor, which he owned. The infant carrier came courtesy of the King of Bling.
Look at him go. Cochise Jones watched the baby formula work its way like mercury in a falling thermometer down the graduations. Intent, pleased, doubtful, as if he had money riding on the outcome. He winked at Archie. Mr. and the late Mrs. Jones never had a child of their own.
Boy, making me thirsty.
Yes, I am feeling quite thirsty myself, said Mr. Merchandani, and Archie felt a flutter of anticipatory dread.
You know, Nat, you really should put in an espresso machine or other form of beverage service.
Archie plunged himself deeper into the mysteries of crate number 8. The theoretical espresso machine was a sore subject.
the most recent of many arguments between the co-owners of Brooklyn, having begun over the question of whether, as Archie had been hinting with increasing heavy-handedness for a couple of years, the time had come to offer more at the counter than unlimited supplies of music and bullshit on tap. Because the truth was, they were already fucked, with or without Gibson Good and his dogpile empire. They were behind on the rent to Singletary. Their inventory was dwindling as their ability to purchase the better collections ran afoul of cash flow problems. Probably if you looked at the matter coolly and rationally, an activity in which neither partner could be said to excel, they were on their last legs. So many of the other used record kings of the East Bay had already gone under, hung it up, or turned themselves into internet-only operations, closing their doors, letting the taps of bullshit go dry. Brooklyn Records was nearly the last of its kind. Ishi, Chingachgook, Martha the Passenger Pigeon. Every time Archie broached the subject of trying some new angle, branching out, beefing up their websites, even, yes, selling coffee drinks and pastries and chai, he ran into heavy resistance from Nat. Not just resistance, the man would shut down the conversation, shut himself down with that infuriating, self-righteous Abraham the Patriarch way he had sometimes, acting as if he and Archie were not a couple of secondary market retailers trying to stay afloat, but guardians of some ancient greatness that must never be tainted or altered. When really, like any religion, Archie supposed, it was a compound of OCD and existential panic, a displaced fear of change. Reroutings of familiar traffic patterns, new watermarks and doodads on the national currency, revised rules for the bundling of recyclables, such things were anathema to Nat Jaffe. Fresh starts, clean slates, reboots, anathema. He stood against them like an island in the flow, a snag of branches. "You want a fucking macchiato?" he had said a couple of days earlier, throwing a record album at Archie, nothing too valuable, just a copy of Stan Getz and J.J. Johnson at the Opera House, Verve 1957. Getz sitting in with Johnson, Oscar Peterson, Ray Brown, and Connie Kay. "Here's your fucking macchiato!" Meaning, sweet light froth of a white guy on top of a dense dark bottom of black. The shot had gone wide, but damn, a flying record? The thing could have sliced Archie's head off. Archie found himself annoyed just thinking about it now. It annoyed him as well that Mr. Merchandani had mentioned the espresso machine, even though he knew that Mr. Merchandani was only trying to help out, take up the cause, join the chorus of those who did not want to see Brooklyn die. There was no mistaking that Matt was on high simmer today, perhaps two bubbles away from a full-on roll. "Gentlemen." It was a mild voice, the voice of a man trained to extol the highest in men and women while seeing them at their lowest, trained to seemliness, to keeping itself soft and low under the pall of remembrance and grief that forever hung over flowers and suns. At the sound of that funereal voice, its head cocked in Singletary's direction, the African gray parrot began to give out, note perfect, Cochise Jones's reading of the old Mahalia Jackson spiritual, Trouble of the World, found on Mr. Jones's only album as a bandleader, Redbonin, CTI, 1973. "Look out," Mr. Jones said, but as usual, 58 was way ahead of him. In the shade of a wide-brimmed black hat whose vibe wavered between Crime Boss and Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West, pinstriped gray on charcoal three-piece, black wing tips shined till they shed a perceptible halo. Chan Flowers came into the store, slid himself through the front door, ineluctable as a final notice from the county. Straight-backed, barrel-chested, bow-legged. A model of probity. A steady hand to reassure the grieving. A sober man. A grave man. Solid as a pillar of a tomb. A good dose of gangster to that hat to let you know the councilman played his politics old school, with a shovel in the dark of the moon. Plus that touch of tombstone, of gothic western undertaker, like maybe sometimes when the moon was full and flowers and suns stood empty and dark but for the vigil lights. Chant flowers might up and straddle a coffin, ride it like a bronco. Looks like we have ourselves the hardcore here today, he said, quickly tallying the faces at the counter before settling on Archie. A question in his eyes, something he wanted to know. Wait out here, he told his nephews. The two Flowers nephews stayed out on the sidewalk. Like all of Mr. Flowers' younger crop of nephews, they seemed not to be wearing their ill-fitting black suits so much as to be squatting inside them until some less embarrassing habitation came along. They had the solemn faces of practical jokers waiting to spring a gag. One of them took out a book of Japanese math puzzles and started working them with a stub of pencil. Mr. Jones, Flowers said, starting in with that politician resolve to fill the boxes of this human Sudoku. Your Honor, said Cochise Jones. Flowers reached for Mr. Jones's octave and a half hands, its nails like chips of piano ivory. The honor is indeed mine, Flowers said, as always to bask in the reflected luster of the legacy you represent. Inventor of the musical styling known as Brooklyn Creole. Mr. Jones was also, as far as Archie knew, the first person to use the term Brooklyn to describe this neighborhood, the ragged fault where the urban plates of Berkeley and Oakland subducted. Hello, 58. There was a silence. The bird regarded Flowers. Say hello, Mr. Jones said.
Say hello, you little jive-ass motherfucker, 58 said.
The voice was that of Cochise Jones, the unmistakable smoker's croak, but way more irritable than Archie had ever heard Mr. Jones become. Everybody laughed except Chan Flowers. His eyes kept aloof from the smile on his lips. Keep it up, Flowers told 58. You know I have a deluxe cherrywood pet casket sitting on my stockroom shelf right now, waiting to house your remains. This was true. Cochise Jones had made funeral arrangements of Egyptian exactitude for himself and his partner in solitude. Brother Singletary, Flowers pointed a slender finger. The King of Bling, how are you, sir? Councilman, Singletary said, looking at Flowers the same way he looked at 58, with a mix of curiosity and distaste, as if touching his tongue to something bitter at the corner of his mouth. The two of them, Singletary and Flowers, had beefed often and openly over the years, always in a civilized way. Lawsuits, real estate, a long Cold War fought against the backdrop of redevelopment money using proxies and attorneys. West Oakland rumor traced the source of beef to the late 1970s, tendering the story that Singletary had married his wife out from under a pre-existing condition of Chan Flowers. Rumor further added the dubious yet somehow creditable information that her reason for choosing Singletary over Flowers came down to an ineradicable odor of putrefaction on the undertaker's hands. I'm all right, lest you here to tell me otherwise. Now you know, Flowers said, half addressing the room, the voice modulated, genial, but not, in spite of the rhetoric, rotund. Cool and dispassionate, as ready to express disappointment as flattery. Back in the Bible, only a king could even wear the bling. They did not call it that, of course, did they, Mr. Oberstein? King Solomon, in his book of Ecclesiastes, do you know the vernacular he employed to allude to that which we now style bling? Moby guessed. Frankincense and myrrh? He called it vanity, said the king of bling. And I got no argument against that. Well, that's fine, because I did not come in here looking for an argument, Flowers said. Mr. S.S. Merchandani, a latecomer to these shores, but wasting no time. Councilman Flowers, good for you, sir, and Mr. Oberstein. Flowers frowned at the Whale attorney, plainly searching for the kind of fitting summary he liked to bestow on people, an epitaph for every headstone. Keeping it real, Nat suggested. No doubt, said Moby, beaming. True dat. Mr. Jaffe, Flowers concluded. He pressed his lips very thin. Councilman? A silence followed, deeper and more awkward than it might have been because Archie had forgotten to turn over the record on the turntable. It was rare, very rare, to see Flowers at a loss for words. Was there guilt on his conscience over changing his mind about the dogpile deal? Had he come in this lunchtime, manned up to break the bad news himself? Or was he so caught up in running his own big-time playbook, in setting up his line to defend against the scramble, that he had forgotten he might run into some resistance at the front counter of Brooklyn? Archie Stallings, Flowers said, and Archie, confused, knowing he probably should play it cold and hostile with Chan Flowers, but in the lifelong habit of looking up to the man, gave himself up to a dap and a bro hug with the councilman. Your dad around? Flowers said, not quite whispering, but nearly so. Archie drew back. But before he could do anything more than squint and look puzzled, Flowers had his answer and was moving on. I seem to remember, he said, letting go of Archie, somebody telling me you had left a message for me, Mr. Jaffe, at my office, not very long ago. Thought I would stop in and inquire as to what it might have been regarding. Probably did, Nat said, still without looking up. At times, his protean hum took the form of an earful poured into the councilman's office answering machine, or, when possible, directly into the ear of one of his nephews, assistants, office managers, press secretaries. Nat complaining about this, that, or the other thing, trash pickup, panhandlers, somebody going around doing stick-ups in broad daylight. Huh? He feigned an effort to remember the reason for his most recent call. Feigned giving up. Can't help you. Huh? The councilman repeated, and there was another silence. Awkward turtle, Julie Jaffe would have declared if he had been present, making a turtle out of his stacked hands, paddling with his thumbs. Now hold on. Look here. Flowers noted the baby who had fallen asleep on the bottle. His eyes went to Archie with unfeigned warmth but flawed mathematics. Is that the little Stallings? Flowers reached out his hand for a standard shake, and Archie took it with a sense of dread, as if this really were his baby and all his impotencies and unfitnesses would stand revealed. I know it might seem impossible, said Flowers, holding on to Archie's hand, still working the room, but I remember when you were that size. Everybody laughed dutifully but sincerely at the idea of Archie's ever having been so small. Child looks just like you two. Oh, no, Archie said. No, that is Aisha Inglis's baby, Rolando, Mr. Singletary's grandson. My wife and I got like a month ago. Nah, I'm just babysitting. Archie is practicing, Mr. Merchandani said. It is never too early to start, Flowers said. Though well provided with nephews and nieces, little shorties all the way up to grown men who'd played football with Archie in high school, Flowers was a bachelor and, like Mr. Jones, had no children of his own. It can definitely sneak up on a man. Maybe I should start practicing being dead, Nat said too loudly. Though whether the excess volume was deliberate or involuntary, Archie could not have said. Before any of them had a chance to fully ponder the import of this remark, Nat added, Oh, yeah, I do remember why I called, Councilman. It was to ask you to come on by and slit my throat. Flowers turned, taken mildly aback, smiled, shook his head. Brother Nat, I will never tire of your sparkling repartee, he said. What a treat it is. Also, I have that sun ra you were looking for, Nat said, banking the anger, using his smile like a valve to feed it nourishing jets of air. I don't know. Maybe you want to wait and pick it up at that new dogpile store of yours. I hear the used wax department is going to be straight up banging. Nat, Archie said. Duly noted, Nat replied without missing a beat. Warn me again in 20 seconds, okay? I can certainly understand your distress at the possibility of the level of competition you are going to be facing, Brother Nat. Flowers said with perfect sympathy. But come on, man, show some faith in your partner and yourself. What's with the defeatist attitude? Maybe you want to consider the possibility your anxiety might be premature. I never actually experienced anxiety that turned out to be premature, Nat said, always happy to keep punching in the clinch. It usually shows up right on time, in my experience. Just this once, then, Flower suggested, itching to get out, tugging at the lapels of his jacket. Premature. Are you saying that Gibson Good, the fifth richest, what is it? Nat turned with an audible creak of his neck bones to Garnett Singletary, who drew back, tight smile noncommittal, in no way, shape, or form interested, not being a fool, and openly taking up against his favorite enemy from way back in the day. Fifth, I believe I read in Black Enterprise that he is currently the fifth most richest African American, Singletary said carefully. I didn't see my own name anywheres on the list. Again, all the men in the store laughed, happy to let Singletary break up the tension. All the same, feeling sympathy for Nat, Archie was certain. The place was part of their lives, including the life of Chan Flowers, who had for years come every week to get his hair cut by Eddie Spencer, and afterward never lost the habit of stopping by. Are you saying, Councilman, that Gibson Good does not have an open field ahead of him, thanks to you, to start putting in this thang 2 blocks down from here, thus effectively cutting not only my throat, but the throat of this great big ex-baby of whom you are so very fond? Because what we heard, and I believe we even heard it from your lips, was that Mr. Good was having serious trouble with some of your friends on the Zoning Commission, and that because of that, in this climate, was the term I believe you employed, the banks were giving him a hard time. If I told you that, Flowers said, I was only reporting what I knew to be the case. So what changed? Or let me rephrase that. How much change did it take? Nat, here's that warning, Archie said. How much cheese, right, Moby? What am I agreeing to? Moby said. Jesus, Nat, Archie said. You had better watch what you say, Mr. Jaffe, Flowers suggested. He was looking at Archie when he said it, not quite in appeal, not quite making some kind of threat. Inquiry widening his eyes when he looked at Archie, something that he would have liked to know. Archie wondered if this question Flowers did not feel comfortable asking in front of a crowd and not Nat's call about a Sun Ra record lay behind today's visit from the councilman. I checked out Dogpile, Nat said. He smiled at Moby. Last summer, Archie and I went down to play that wedding in Fox Hills. It was, truly, extremely banging. They had a sweet Nubian lady, Roy Merriweather. The pricing was more than competitive. What's more, I got into a very interesting discussion, 40-45 minutes, with the manager of the used vinyl department. Young guy. College guy. Black, good-looking, very passionate about Ornette Coleman, making a case that Coleman basically rediscovered the original tone of the New Orleans cornet players, basically thought his way back to it like Einstein thinking about passing trains. And that closed the circuit. The story ended. That was the end of jazz as we know it. Kind of an Ouroboros thing, the snake swallowing its own tail. I don't know if I completely agree, but it was an interesting argument. Oh, I also picked up a really decent out there. I don't go in for the hyperbole the way my partner does, Councilman, Archie said. You know that. And I apologize on his behalf for the disrespect, which you won't hear any more of, or I'm going to kick his ass from here to the Carquinez Bridge. Right, Nat? But look here. If you come through for Gibson Good, after all this time, you've been such a good customer to us. Not to mention, you know, blessing us with the example of your coming in here and meeting some of your music needs from time to time. Then with respect, excuse me, but you really did turn your back on us. Seems like. Flower's gaze slid over to the sleeping baby. He seemed to be seeing little Archie himself lying there, hearing some wah-wah echo of 1968. I sincerely hope that is not true, he said, returning to the present. I would miss this place, I truly, truly would, but a dogpile thing is going to be a real boon to the community.
The community?
Oh, shit, Archie thought.
The community?
Nat repeated. Be cool, Nat, Archie said.
Oh, sure, I'll be cool. I'll be really fucking cool when I'm down the street selling my blood plasma. Nat.
Having to sell his blood plasma was always Nat's worst-case scenario. The example he gave to his son, his wife, his partner, anyone he needed to persuade of the dire expedience and financial ruin that loomed before him.
You know, Councilman, I don't know why, but I was under the impression that this place right here,
and Nat pounded the counter,
right here was a community, but I guess I was wrong.
Nat reached under the counter and pulled out a copy of The Soul Vibrations of Man, Saturn Research, 1976, and hurled it across the room. You could hear it crack, a snapping like wood in a fire. Along with fretting about having recourse to selling his blood plasma, Nat liked to throw record albums, usually the slag. Alas, this one was rare and valuable.
You can ask Gibson Good and the community to find you a sealed original mono copy of The Soul Vibrations of Man, because we're closing right now, as of this moment. Why delay it? Why draw out the suffering? We are closing this store today. You can all leave. Thank you very much for your support all these years. Goodbye, gentlemen.
Flowers started to say something, to remonstrate with Nat, reproach him for the destruction of that beautiful disc. Thought better of it. Fixed those searching peepers on Archie one last time, seeming to see some kind of answer in Archie's blankness. Well then, Flowers touched his fingers to the brim of his hat, bowed to the men at the counter. He walked out of the store, and the nephews took up their places on either side of him. Enjoy your day, Mr. Jones, Mr. Singletary.
Gentlemen, goodbye,
Nat said. The customers turned, looking dazed. Mr. Merchandani and Moby appealing to Archie. Archie shrugged. Sorry, fellas, he said. Archie picked up Rolando, snoozing in his caddy, and made a formal transfer of custody to the grandfather, England turning over Hong Kong, mournful trumpets of farewell, a weird ache in Archie's heart, like the forerunner or possibly the distant memory of tears. The men slipped from their stools and trooped out. Mr. Jones stopped in the doorway, unhunched himself from the perpetual ghostly keyboard, and turned back. He shot a look at Nat in which sympathy and scorn contended, fished his pipe and tobacco out of his hip pocket. Then, gesturing with the stem of the pipe toward Rolando as the king carried out the baby, Mr. Jones nodded to Archie.
You keep on practicing, Turtle, he said. You gonna get it.
I hope I do, Mr. Jones. You got the good heart underneath all the other stuff. Good heart is 85% of everything in life. Tears ran burning along the gutters of Archie's eyes. Generally, he tried, following the example of Marcus Aurelius, to avoid self-pity, but Archie had not experienced a great deal of appreciation in his life for his good qualities, for his potential as a man. His mother had died when he was young. His father had bounced early on. The aunts who raised him died with the ignorance of his good qualities perfectly preserved. His wife, though no doubt she loved him, was the latest in a long line of experts and connoisseurs, reaching back through the army and high school to his aunties, to underrate the rarity and condition of Archie's soul. Only Mr. Jones had always stopped to drop a needle in the long, inward spiraling groove that encoded Archie and listened to the vibrations. Even in the days when Mr. Jones's wife was alive, and he was sought after in the clubs and recording studios, halfway famous, he always seemed to have time for Turtle Stallings. Thanks, Mr. Jones, Archie said. What's the other 15%? Nat said, just out of curiosity.
Politeness, Mr. Jones said without hesitation, and keeping a level head.
Nat blushed and failed to meet Mr. Jones's watery gaze.
We got that gig tomorrow, Mr. Jones said. I'ma need my Leslie, boy.
And you will have it, Archie said.
Said it would be ready Sunday.
It will be.
After the parrot had piloted Mr. Jones out of the store, Nat shut the door behind them. He bolted it, turned the sign so that it read, closed.
The community, he muttered.
He stood with his hand on the bolt, humming. Then he slid it back, pulled the door open, and ran out onto the sidewalk, shouting in the direction Councilman Flowers had taken.
The community hasn't made a decent record since 1989!
Nat came back in, stomped, really, and repeated the business with the deadbolt. He went back around the counter and stood, breathing in and out, making an effort to calm himself, the pounding of his heart visible in his temples. He stopped in front of Archie and fixed him with a level stare.
See, Archie, this is why I hate everyone and the world, he said, as if there was some connection between these words and what had just happened, some sequence of events like a theory of Ornette Coleman and the lost horn men of Storyville.
This is why I hate my sad-ass little life.
He snatched his hat from the hook, pulled it down tight over his head, and went out. Archie tried and failed to decide whether to take seriously any, some portion, or none of the things that Nat had said. He reached for the Penguin Meditations, stashed at the ready in his hip pocket. But he knew without consulting it what Marcus was unlikely to suggest. The kind of solace a man could find in the heat and spice of Ethiopia. A rank sweet sauce on the fingertips. Gwen Shanks was headed north on Telegraph Avenue, on her way to a home birth in the Berkeley Hills, when she found herself blown off course by an unbearable craving into the cumin-scented gloom of the Queen of Sheba. Steeled by a lifetime of training in the arts of repression, like Spock battling the septenary mating madness of the Pon Farr, Gwen had resisted the urges and surges of estrogen and progesterone for each of the 34 weeks of her pregnancy, denying all cravings, battened down tight against hormonal gusts. In her patients, Gwen uniformly and with tenderness indulged the rages, transports, and panics, the crying jags and cupcake benders, but she was not in the habit of indulging herself. Though she was a midwife by profession, her life's work was self-control. 2 weeks earlier, however, without explanation, her husband had dropped by the offices of Berkeley Birth Partners bearing, satanically, a fateful styrofoam cup filled with something called suff. Since that day, Gwen had been plagued by an almost daily hankering for this chilled infusion of sesame seeds, its flavor bittersweet as regret. A black belt in Wing Chun-style kung fu, Gwen had spent the morning in the dojo of the Bruce Lee Institute, working out for over 2 hours with her master, Irene Ju, making a conscious effort not only to sharpen her practical edge against the loss of focus, strength, and quickness that pregnancy had brought, but more important, to regain some measure of discipline over herself. Wasted time. Parking in a yellow zone, risking lateness, Gwen abandoned herself to her thirst. She was standing by the cash register, waiting for her change, and had taken her first painful and blessed sip when she noticed her darling husband sitting in a booth halfway back along the south wall, behind a tan and brown curtain of beaded strands that managed, in its sparsity, to leave nothing and everything to the imagination. Archie Stallings, dog of dogs, his thick Mingus fingers all up in a sticky compound of injera, and the business of a long-headed, rust-brown young bitch with the wondrous huge eyes of some nocturnal mammal. Elizabeth Getachew, the Queen of Sheba, coiled on her side of the table like a soft and sinister intention. Across from her, Archie took off his horn rims, polished their lenses with a soft cloth. That was all she saw. Though it did not quite qualify as innocent, it was, in all fairness, not much.
Afterward, she could not be sure how or why she conceived the idea of marching back to the curtain booth and dumping a nice cold styrofoam cup full of frothy regret onto her darling husband's head. Idea was not even the right word. She seemed at that instant to define herself as the woman who was going to do that thing, to be the sea in which that action was the one and only fish. Throughout her pregnancy, attacks of fatigue had alternated with bouts of bodily exultation. But as she marched, rolling with the weight of the baby well distributed along the engineering of her bones, over to the fifth booth from the back, Gwen felt positively indomitable. She flung aside the beaded strands with a left hand that could splinter pine planks and reduce cinder block to gray dust. Strings snapped. Hundreds of brown and tan beads rattled down, darting and pinging and scattering in whirls, mapping like particles in a cloud chamber, the flow of Qigong from her black belt hand. In fact, Gwen disbelieved in Qi, and in 97% of the claims that people in the Kung Fu world made about it, those stories of people who could lift Acuras and avert bullets and bust the heads of mighty armies by virtue of the ability to control the magic flow. 97% was more or less the degree to which Gwen disbelieved in everything that people represented, attested to, or tried to put over on you. And despite midwives' latter-day reputation as a bunch of New Age witches, with their crystals and their Alpha State Gong CDs and their tinctures of black and blue cohorse root, most midwives were skeptical by training, Gwen more skeptical than most. Nonetheless, she felt something coursing through her and around her, mapped by the flying beads. She glowered down at the bastard who had somehow managed to conceal his bulk behind her 3% blind spot and sneak into her life. As soon as Gwen appeared alongside the booth, Archie seemed to cotton all at once on to the whole scenario. Wife, discovery, beads, size large suff, with the instantaneous understanding common to unfaithful men. In the space of that instant, his eyes widened, apologizing, protesting, as wooden beads rained around him and 18 ounces of ice-cold Ethiopian beverage were upended onto his head. Damn, he said, as the milk-white stuff streamed down his glasses and alongside his nose into his collar. He did not lose his temper, raise his voice, jump out of the way, or even shake himself like the dog he was. He just sat there dripping, suffering the punishment, as if doing so were a form of uxorious indulgence, the price that must be paid for having a wife who was not merely pregnant, but apparently out of her mind. I was only talking to the girl. Excuse me, said Elizabeth Getachew, with her husky accent, attempting with head lowered to slide out of the booth. Her hair was a glory of tendrils for the snaring of husbands. She smelt violently of the kitchen, of nuts and oils and crushed handfuls of orange spice. Gwen interposed herself between the woman and freedom, glad to be huge and impassable. She waited until the young woman looked up, daring her to meet the wifely gaze, a wall, a dam, the arm of a government. The girl looked up. In those ibex eyes, Gwen saw guilt and mockery, but above all, contempt. All at once, the lights came on inside of Gwen. She looked down at her belly, at her pilled and distended stretch top, at the saggy knees of her CP shades pants, at the ragged black espadrilles into which she stuffed her feet. And under all that, the preposterous bra, the geriatric panties. No excuse for you, Gwen said feebly and stepped aside. Elizabeth Getachew slipped past her and disappeared through another fringe of beads into the kitchen. Apart from the happy couple, there were now 9 other human beings in the dining room, and all of them appeared to be enjoying the ongoing spectacle of Gwen. So what? Archie wanted to know. Now I'm not allowed to interact with my fellow neighborhood merchants? Maintain the dialogue? How are we supposed to keep a lid on crime we don't exchange tips and information? Tell me that. tips, and information, she quoted. Uh-huh, I see. Always have to assume the worst-case scenario.
He grabbed up some napkins and tenderly patted his pate, dabbed at his streaming cheeks. He shook his head.
I just go with the odds, Archie, Gwen said. I'm looking at the numbers.
Yes, she conceded as he followed her out the front door of the restaurant and down Telegraph to her black 1999 BMW convertible. Archie and Elsabet had appeared to be just talking, and if they were just talking, then it was completely and without question unreasonable for her to have bugged out on him the way she had. Given the innocence of the observed encounter, it was wrong to have gone and drenched his beautiful pumpkin sweater and tweeds in a soft drink from the Horn of Africa. Yes, she knew perfectly well that Archie ate lunch at Queen of Sheba all the time. She knew that Elzebeth Getachew worked at the restaurant and that she was the niece of the owner, who was a nice guy. And no, she did not expect him to be rude to a friend and fellow member of the Temescal Merchants Association.
It's the indignity of it, she heard herself telling him, invoking a key concept of her mother's code of morality with such stone likeness that it chilled her. Spiders walked on the back of her neck. You might as well swing the camera around and show Rod Serling standing there behind a potted banana tree in an airy cloud of cigarette smoke. She got right up in his face so she could make her speech without raising her voice. I have been doing this for 36 weeks, she began. I am tired, I am large, I am hormonal, and I am hot. I am so hot and so large, I have to wear a culotte slip to keep my thighs from rubbing together when I walk. So, I admit, yes, I lost it. Maybe I ought not to have poured my drink on your head, but I don't know. Was this the prompting of estrogen or logic? Could she tell the difference anymore? Maybe I ought. Because even if you are just talking to some astonishingly beautiful girl, Archie, it's humiliating. I'm sick of it. I have to walk around my city, the place where I live, and wonder if next time I stop in, wherever, I don't know, the drugstore to pick up a jar of Tuck's medicated pads, I'm going to see my husband macking on the pharmacist. This was not a hypothetical example. It's embarrassing. I have more pride than that. She placed a hand against her sternum then, feeling the next words coming like a mighty belch. She lowered her voice to a whisper, as if being obliged to invoke the memory of her immensely dignified mother, only the second female African-American graduate of Harvard Medical School, were the greatest humiliation of all. I have too much self-respect.
Way too much, Archie agreed.
Swear to me, Archie, she said. Raise your right hand and swear to me, on the soul of your mother, you aren't getting up to anything with that girl, Chewbacca, or whatever her name is.
I swear, Archie said.
But there was appended no oath that might require the damnation of his late mother. No raised hand.
Raise it up, Gwen said.
Archie lifted his right hand, a flag of surrender.
Swear. On the soul of your mother, who raised you to be a better man than that.
Before forming the words required, Archie hesitated, and in that half second he was lost. All Gwen's protestations of dignity and invocations of self-respect were scattered like deck chairs on the promenade of a heaving ship. She glanced up and down the street, casing it for witnesses, then plunged her hand down into the front of his pants. The upper serif of his belt buckle, a gold Ferragamo F, scraped her wrist. Her fingers found the heavy coil of hose cupped in the bag of his boxers. Her fingertips were briefly snagged by a film of bodily adhesive as weak as the glue on a Post-it. She tugged her sticky fingers loose, brought them to her nose, and took a quick but practiced sniff. Market stalls, smoking braziers, panniers of lentils, all the spice and stink of Ethiopia, turmeric, scorched butter, the salt of the Red Sea.
Motherfucker, Gwen said,
turning on itself like a cell going cancerous, the oath that Archie would not swear. It was only the third time in her life that she had used the word, and the first time without quotation marks demurely implied,
and after it, there was nothing more to say. Gwen went around to the driver's side of the car, ignoring a parking citation in an acid green envelope that had been poked, during her absence, under her left wiper. She guided herself into the space between the seat and steering wheel. Then she and her battered dignity drove off, with the parking ticket flapping against the windshield, and with the want of a cup of suff. For one more caramel sip of which she just then would have endured any affront to her self-esteem or stain upon her pride, doomed to burn on inside her, unassuaged for many days.